The Guardian.
Welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. We thought the season was over, but it's not. Still plenty to be decided, including the richest game in football. Two Fulham stunners put them in control of their tie with Cardiff, while Brentford boss Thomas Frank bemoans VAR as they trail Swansea at the halfway stage of the Championship playoffs. How many players can the Premier League's relegated sides keep hold of? The transfer madness starts now, with windows opening, shutting and slamming all over the place. We'll also round up the Serie A season with Sarri celebrating in his 60s, as well as taking your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Well, as ever, we have a panel, of course. The Guardian's Jacob Steinberg. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. You?
Yes, very well, thank you. Football consultant, writer and scout, Jonathan Faduba. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you for having me back on the show. Hope you're well.
Yeah, I saw that you'd made your debut the other day. Did enough to come back. Love that.
Yeah, I've got the recall.
And Barry, and Barry Glendenning, I've missed you. How are you doing?
I'd say you've missed me like a turkey misses Christmas, Faye. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. Right, we've got so much to crack on with. So we'll kick off with the Championship playoffs, which was essentially London versus Wales. Cardiff City 0, Fulham 2, without Golden Boot winning striker Alexander Mitrovic. That was confirmed an hour before kickoff that he wouldn't be risked after picking up a minor injury. And actually, Fulham didn't need him. Josh Onuma's amazing goal. Let's talk about that first and foremost. So much technique. It was almost like a dance weaving past three defenders, Jacob.
Yeah, he was obviously someone who came through at Tottenham and a lot was expected from him and it didn't really pan out for him. It was a bit of a shame because obviously at Spurs there was Pochettino there at the time when he broke through and he was giving so many opportunities to young players and he tried him out in a few cup games. I remember watching him against Wickham when Wickham turned up at the old White Hart Lane in, I think, 2017 or 2018 in the FA Cup. And Wickham were 2-0 up at half-time and Onuma had played just behind the striker. It was a bit of a weakened Spurs side. And I think he got taken off quite early by Pochettino. And it just kind of felt at that point like it wasn't going to happen for him at Spurs. And I don't think, you know, the loan at Aston Villa necessarily worked out too well, but that at Fulham, it's been a good opportunity for him to sort of get himself going again, and that was an absolutely incredible goal, which will maybe show that he could potentially do it in the Premier League if they get another chance. If either if they go up or a Premier League side maybe looks at him and thinks there's potential here to unlock.
Well, certainly he'll have attracted plenty of attention after that. And then, I mean, the cherry on the already iced cake was Neeskens Cabano free kick in stoppage time, Barry.
Yeah, it was a wonderful free kick. Neil Harris was very unhappy that the free kick was given because a similar foul by a Fulham player on Thomas Kearney on Morrison went unpunished earlier in the game. It was almost identical. And when Harris pointed this out to the ref, I think the ref sort of, what has he said? He said, two wrongs don't make a right, which really doesn't make any sense whatsoever because he was basically conceding that he'd either got both wrong or neither wrong. I'm not really sure what he meant. But anyway, Neil Harris, who I have a lot of time for since his time at Millwall. Like Max, I have a big team who doesn't win things and it's Millwall. So I appreciated Neil Harris's efforts there. He always had them punching above his weight and I think maybe he has Cardiff punching above their weight now. But the Cabano's goal was a wonderful free kick. A 2-0 lead was, I'd say, the very least Fulham deserved when you consider their dominance. And it's hard to see them blowing it from here, but anything is possible.
Yeah, Neil Harris, you mentioned there, was also really unhappy with Fulham's celebrations. He thought they went too far. Scott Parker, though, said nothing was over the top. He thought his team were pretty professional and that they understand that the tie is only halfway there. Let's bring in our super sub producer, Sammy, because he's a massive Fulham fan. So apologies to all those Cardiff supporters out there. But was that an even better performance than you were expecting, Sammy?
Yeah, definitely. I think we saw the test that Cardiff would give us. We had a bit of a dress rehearsal against them 2 weeks ago and we won 2-0. But I was expecting to win this over two legs, but to beat them in such a comprehensive fashion in the first leg was really, really incredible. And fair play to Scott. And it's two underappreciated players in Neeskens Cabano and Josh Onoma who have really stepped up for us. And someone like Neeskens has been a bit part player for 4 years and then has got three free kicks in three games. It's and playing really well as well. So I guess it's a real underdog story for those two players to be the heroes of the hour.
Was it a little bit of a worry? You were under quite a lot of pressure in those opening exchanges.
Definitely, and that clearance off the line after half an hour by Michael Hector is absolutely brilliant. And Cardiff started strong. It's what you'd expect from a Neil Harris side. They put us under a lot of pressure. They got good physicality, and I was a bit worried, but also feeling quite confident with Fulham that when the pressure is on, we are seeming to keep clean sheets and keep it fairly tidy and not concede too many chances. So I was a little bit concerned, but also I've got growing faith in this Fulham side that we are going to hold on and see things out. And we did that, really.
That's a bit of a change from the previous season, that they're able to keep a few clean sheets.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that is a massive change. You know, we came up under Slavisa, this swashbuckling side that would blow teams apart with beautiful football. This is not the same Fulham anymore. Whilst we do keep possession, it's much more pragmatic. It's much more get a goal, hold on, keep it tight. And I guess that is quite predictable for a Scott Parker side. It's a team playing a little bit in his image in that way, but there's still some beautiful football in there, but it's not the same Fulham that came up in 2018, and fingers crossed, if we did go up to the Premier League, it might be a slightly more sustainable approach to trying to stay in the league. But we're not there yet. We've literally won one game out of three that we need to win.
Yeah, it's efficient, isn't it? And efficiency is pretty important. Jonathan, Fulham relegated last season. Can you see them going straight back up? Would they deserve to be back in the Premier League?
I think it'll be a tough game, whoever they face, if they are to go through. I mean, I don't think the tie's necessarily over. Obviously, Cardiff are going to have something to say in the second leg, I'd imagine. Neil Harris will have the side pumped up, you would think. And obviously Brentford and Swansea are two really good sides, so it's definitely not done and dusted. I think they have the ability. I think regarding Cabano and Josh Onoma, for me, I found it really interesting. I think they're both really good case studies in sort of talent identification. I mean, as Jacob mentioned there, like Onoma was one of the players who came through England's youth teams. He was in England's youth teams all the way through, was part of England's under-17 World Cup winning squad. And then kind of just had a period where he drifted for Spurs for two or three years, never was given more than 45 minutes in the Premier League for Spurs. And now he's got sort of 70 games or so under his belt. So he's just gradually developing. And Cabano, a strange one, but I remember watching him at PSG when I used to work in French football, and he came through at PSG, never really made it. And it's just, I couldn't believe he's 28, to be honest. It made me feel quite old just to see that I thought he was still kind of maybe fairly young, but yeah, he's coming towards the end of his career there, but as you mentioned, Sammy, that he's kind of now starting to have his time in the spotlight, maybe at Fulham, and finally just maybe getting a little bit of limelight and consistency. But as you said, Barry, they were kind of dancing around quite a lot after the game, and I don't know if there's just a little bit of complacency there, or they were just over exuberant at the time. But yeah, I don't think the tie's finished yet. It's gonna be an interesting second leg.
Can well, I just certainly say that Jonathan saying Neeskens made him feel quite old has made me feel quite old.
Absolutely. Well, I remember Josh Onoma making me feel really old because I interviewed him back when he was 18, and it was a really early start for an interview. I had to be there at 8 o'clock, and he turned up 4 hours late. I was hungover and I was not happy. So actually he's redeemed himself with that goal last night. It was pretty beautiful to watch. Sammy, just finally, if you get there, and there's a big if, because, you know, we're not writing Cardiff off. We know exactly what Neil Harris's sides can do. But if you got there, who would you rather play in the final, Brentford or Swansea?
Swansea. For more reasons than just I think we'd have more of a chance of beating Swansea.
They're the informed team though, Swansea.
They are. My nightmare is losing to Brentford in a playoff final at Wembley, so I would just rather avoid that at all costs. Yeah, Swansea are a good side, and they've much improved this side of the calendar year with Rhian Brewster and Conor Gallagher really pulling the strings there. But no, I would much rather fancy Swansea. So I will be donning a white shirt tomorrow.
Sammy, could I just ask about Tom Kearney?
Yeah.
As far as I can remember, his season in the Premier League was curtailed a bit by injury. And he didn't have a great time there. And I had high hopes for him. Was there ever any chance a Premier League side might have come in for him last summer? Or
I think there's been lots of links, often linking Tom Kearney to West Ham. I don't think it's ever really looked like a serious proposition. He signed a long-term deal last summer. And now I actually don't know if a Premier League side would be interested in Kearney. I think that his performance levels are not as high as they were 2 years ago. I still think he's a very, very talented footballer on his day, but I don't think he's quite as instrumental to Fulham as he certainly was a couple of years ago under Slavisa. So I can see him staying at Fulham for a long time, which is great because he's our captain and he's someone that knows the side well, but I don't personally see him moving on anytime soon.
Second leg is at Craven Cottage on Thursday. And as you said there, the second leg of Swansea-Brentford is tomorrow, Wednesday. Swansea taking a 1-0 lead into that. Andre Ayew winning it for the Swans with that gorgeous volley just 16 minutes after his penalty had been saved by joint Golden Glove winner David Raya. How much did you enjoy this game and how efficient was it from a Swansea point of view before we get into all the controversy?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good game. I enjoyed it. I think they're two really entertaining sides to watch. Obviously, Swansea have Rhian Brewster, who's on loan from Liverpool. Very exciting talent. Andre Ayew, I thought, had a really good game. Obviously, missed the penalty, but then showed his kind of character to come back and scored a brilliant goal. There was a lot of controversy, you know, regarding the sending off and that kind of thing. But yes, Brentford just have tailed off a little bit in the last few games. It was similar against Barnsley as well. And they, you know, they had chances and didn't quite take them. And yeah, they've just gone off the boil slightly in when it counts most, maybe. And so, yeah, it was an enjoyable game, I thought. But I think there's a long way to go. I think that second leg is going to be very, very, very interesting.
Yeah, and Brentford obviously with a massive point to prove. Rico Henry sent off for that lunging challenge on Conor Roberts on 65 minutes. Brentford fans furious with the red card. Thomas Frank furious with the red card. The official Twitter account even said it wasn't even a foul. So come on, Barry, are they right?
I thought maybe it was a yellow. I didn't think it was a red. But now that the red has been given, Brentford said they were going to appeal it. And I really don't think, at the time we're recording, there hasn't been a result of that appeal that I can find anyway. But I don't think there's enough there to get it overturned. It wasn't an egregious error on the part of Keith Stroud, who's the referee. I think a yellow would have been enough. I do think it was a foul. I would have to beg to differ with the Brentford Twitter account on that. But yeah, Thomas Frank is furious over it, but these things happen. He's also said that they should have VAR in these playoffs because it's, you know, there's so much at stake. But even if they had VAR, there's no guarantee the ref would have changed his mind, I think. And if Thomas Frank has been keeping an eye on some of the decisions and VAR consultations in the Premier League, he would probably know that there's no guarantee it would have been overturned. But yeah, maybe he has a point about introducing VAR in these lucrative games, but you know, I don't think it should be in any game.
To be honest, I think Thomas Frank has a very good point there, Jacob. I mean, I've interviewed him a few times and he is always incredibly what's the best way to put this, he's very measured and analytical in the way he does his post-match interviews, which is exactly how he prepares for games as well. But that's definitely the tetchiest I've seen him, and you can understand when there's so much at stake why VAR, there is an argument for it in these kind of games. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that the only issue you may have around implementing it is that it hasn't been in for the whole season. So, it's still a championship game. It's still part of the EFL and it's not used there. So are you suddenly changing the conditions for a select group of games, which would be the argument?
But they do that with the FA Cup, because it's something I've always been really cross about, because you have it in some FA Cup games and not others. And if you're so, you know, bearing in mind that this is almost separate because the rest of the EFL season has been concluded and it's just these three games, that there could be, I see your point, but you know, the counter argument to that is that it's almost a separate little mini tournament in itself.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. I think it was the first season they used it in the FA Cup. Obviously, there was a lot of controversy around that, because you had, like, it was across, I think, the quarterfinals where, was it when Swansea were 2-0 up against Manchester City, and City came back, and I think, was it that there wasn't VAR used in that game, and then there were certain grounds where it was used, and VAR might have come in at certain times to overturn decisions, and you felt the conditions in that point were slightly just lopsided, and certain teams were benefiting and certain teams were suffering. So yeah, that's a fair argument. Their argument, I guess, is that it changes the conditions, but with so much riding on the team who potentially goes up, the team that fails to get promotion, then yeah, there's an argument for making it as clean cut as possible. Then again, I mean, as Barry says, that you're not necessarily even going to get the right decision with VAR. We've seen on multiple occasions in the Premier League.
Right, that's it for part one. In part two, we're going to take a look at the summer transfer window, with rumours swirling around already. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Right, it's that time, transfers. I mean, we've had plenty of rumours going around for a while now, but we've had a couple of things confirmed over the last couple of days. Dejan Lovren has joined Zenit St. Petersburg from Liverpool. 6 years he spent at Anfield, 8 goals and 185 appearances. It was announced late yesterday, Adam Lallana joined Brighton on a 3-year deal from Liverpool. Graham Potter very excited about that. What difference do you think he's going to make to Brighton, Jonathan?
I think he probably wouldn't have gone there if he wasn't assured first team football. So I think he'll go straight into the team, probably be one of their key players. I think he'll add that bit of experience. They've got quite a few players who are maybe lacking in sort of top level experience, the likes of Aaron Connolly and Alexis McAllister, who you've spoken about before, and those kind of players. So I think he'll come in and just add that experience. I think he's signed a 3-year deal, so you know he's obviously been given assurances. I think Graham Potter's trying to build a kind of younger team, so I'd look at Lallana as coming in and maybe even potentially being kind of captain material eventually in that sense. I think he'll be one of the senior members of the dressing room and just give them that added kind of quality that they need.
That's interesting. See if Lewis Dunk goes anywhere. Jafet Tanganga has also signed a new 5-year contract at Tottenham after having a breakthrough campaign this season, slightly derailed by that back injury he's had since lockdown. But let's have a look at who the so-called, hate using this term, big teams need. I mean, Liverpool, there's been a lot of talk. What do they do now? How do they've won everything. How do they progress next season and become as dominant as perhaps Manchester City have been over the last few years? What would you say they were missing, Barry?
I think they probably need to freshen up the front three. Not that there's anything wrong with the front three they have, who've had a wonderful season, but
I'll take the front three at Luton.
But just, I don't know, a big name striker who's going to come in, probably accept that he won't be a regular starter, but just keep the lads on their toes up front. I think they probably need a deputy for Fabinho. I mean, I look at that Liverpool team and I struggle to find any area of it that needs improvement. I certainly think they do need to improve it. You know, you can't stagnate and you have to strengthen, but I'm not sure how they can strengthen that team because they're so bloody good. So, you know, a few high-profile deputies maybe who aren't going to be regular starters but will really push the regular starters.
Yeah. What about Manchester City, Jacob? Because, you know, a lot was said about the failure to replace Vincent Kompany. What's Pep Guardiola going to be looking for over the summer?
I think the first place for them to start is definitely in defence. It's clear to see where the weaknesses have been this season. The inability to replace Kompany was huge for them, and then exacerbated by Laporte getting injured at the start of the season. And you end up taking Fernandinho, who is getting on, out of the midfield where he was such an influential player last season, and putting him into central defence. He's still a fantastic player, Fernandinho, but there are times where that lack of pace will get exposed. I think that we really saw that in that game where Chelsea beat them to confirm Liverpool winning the title. The centre-back was a huge issue for them. Even the left-back, Mendy, making that mistake for the first Pulisic goal. So, yep, that's where they need to start. I think that there have been the obvious links with Nathan Ake at Bournemouth, who may end up being not too pricey given that Bournemouth have gone down. I think it'd be interesting to see whether or not they may look at Declan Rice at West Ham. Someone once told me that he thought that Declan Rice was a very Pep player because of the way that he can slot into defence or midfield. Is he potentially the player who we all thought that John Stones could be? Obviously, Stones has massively regressed in the last two or three years at City when so much was expected from him. And I think that as well, there'd probably be a little bit of tweaking up front, potentially on the wide positions, you know, with Sané having gone. The obvious player, the one who's being linked by the Manchester press loads, is Ferran Torres at Valencia. And it seems like City want to move quite quickly on him.
Mm. It's really interesting you mentioned Declan Rice there, because he's been linked, as you would expect, with a number of teams. Of course, he started his career at Chelsea and was let go as a youngster and picked up by West Ham on the suggestion of John Terry, actually. But Manchester United being really strongly linked with him. And actually, this is what happens with social media, isn't it? Everybody is straight on this. Declan Rice liked an Instagram post saying big transfer window on the horizon for Manchester United. What do you think that means, Jonathan?
I think it means he likes the post that says big transfer window coming for Manchester United. yeah, there's always that kind of, it's like a new era of rumours, isn't it? Like someone likes a post on Instagram or, I don't know, follows Pogba on Twitter and suddenly it's like he's going to Man United, that kind of thing. I think part of the Chelsea rumours are mainly just because he's best friends with Mason Mount, to be honest. There's a lot of, you know, that's partly one of the main reasons that people seem to link the two together. Although, like you say, he used to play for the club and I think he'd fit in quite well at Chelsea. But I would say about Declan Rice, I thought in some of the games towards the end of the season, he really looked like he kind of just started to have that bit of maturity about him, as if he's just getting used to the league now and kind of knows it and knows what he's doing. And I think he just started to have that confidence about him. He was sort of barking orders at people. And I liked what I saw in the last few games. So I think he is getting to that level now where he will be start to link with, you know, bigger clubs.
At the start of the season, he was struggling partly because he was carrying the side, because the football under Pellegrini was so loose and disorganised and much more disciplined under David Moyes. And he started to really drive and show his ability to quick feet on the ball. So I think that the links with Chelsea are much more than it being simply down to the Mason Mount friendship. Lampard does want him, but anybody who does want him are going to have to pay a big price.
To him liking an Instagram post, let's not forget that Declan Rice once liked playing for the Republic of Ireland as well.
I knew you were going to mention that.
Yeah, but anyway, there's only another 69 days of this nonsense to go.
Well, listen, there's more nonsense to come. And actually, Declan Rice does fit the kind of Manchester United philosophy, landing young British talent. Of course, they're also linked with Jadon Sancho. Now, there's a little bit of confusion regarding this one. We still don't know for definite whether Manchester United had an £89 million bid rejected for him. Reports kind of around suggesting that they'd prepared a new offer with Borussia Dortmund demanding £109 million. I mean, is he worth that? And I'm going to talk to Barry in a minute about the inflated transfer, or deflated in post-COVID times, transfer window money. But he scored 20, created a further 20 in just 44 games this season. So is he worth that kind of money, Jacob?
It's hard to tell how much a player is worth in this market because of the impact of the pandemic. But the numbers that you've just mentioned would suggest that he is. I think that the information would seem to be that Dortmund are going to hold out for that price, despite the fact that he's not going to sign a new contract. And I do think that Manchester United need a player in that position. I think that while there's been a lot of talk around them potentially not needing anybody up front because of the emergence of Mason Greenwood, I think we've seen, and okay, it's been very hectic over the last few weeks, and it's a completely different set of circumstances in which we're playing. But I think you've seen in the last couple of games, the semi-final, the draw with West Ham, that they don't have a lot of depth at Manchester United. They've got young players who potentially, if you're playing 50 to 60 games a season, as Manchester United would intend to, who are going to need to be able to rotate them, and they weren't able to do that in those games. And I think it certainly cost them a place in the cup final. It almost cost them a place in the top four. I don't think you can rely on Greenwood to play a whole season to that level, as good as he is. I don't think they've really had a top right winger for quite a long time. So yeah, I think he would be worth that money to them. His age would also mean that he is probably going to make them that money back.
And of course, with Champions League football secured as well, you know, that rotation policy even more important. Jack Grealish as well, Barry. Dean Smith joked that he gave Grealish a few shots and got him to sign a new Villa contract. It's looking like £80 million might do it. Manchester United looking like the preferred destination. Where would you like to see him play his football?
I'd be happy enough to see him go to Manchester United or abroad, try his luck abroad. I get the impression that's, and I could be completely wrong, that's not something he would ideally like. I think he'd rather stay in England. But it's true, I've no real idea how perilous the finances are at football clubs, but because of the COVID virus and all the fallout from that, but it will be interesting to see what kind of fees are paid. If Grealish does want to leave Villa, as seems to be the case, how little or would they be prepared to accept for him? I think Wilfred Zaha is an interesting example. Say he wants to leave Crystal Palace. There would be no shortage of takers, but the fee being mentioned for him last summer was astronomical. Now, if you are at a club and you want to make a big name signing, would you be prepared to risk that amount of money and the wages you would have to pay him on a player who has had a big move already that didn't work out, on a player that, and apparently it didn't work out because he was sad about leaving London and feeling
homesick. He was significantly younger though then, wasn't he?
That is true, yes. But he's also a bit flaky. He blows hot and cold. He had a good first half of the season this season. It hasn't been great since restart. But, you know, he's been carrying that Crystal Palace team for years. Is he more suited to being a big fish in a small pond, or can he be quite a large fish in an aquarium full of similarly sized or bigger fish? We don't know. But it would be interesting to see who would risk spending a huge amount of money on him and in these strange times, how much they would be prepared to pay for him. I could envisage a scenario where he could possibly still be at Crystal Palace at the start of next season and not be particularly happy about it. Although, to be fair to him, when he didn't get a move last summer, he did knuckle down and he didn't sulk or throw the toys out of the pram. So he deserves credit for that.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting to see whether it's a tropical aquarium somewhere abroad, or whether he stays in a pond in the cold in the UK somewhere. Where do you think he'll go, Jonathan?
I would love him to go to Borussia Dortmund, to be honest. I think he'd be tailor-made for them. I think Zaha, yeah, he's come to a time where I really feel he needs to leave Palace now. I think it's just best for all parties. I think they could get a good fee for him. Rumours to clubs like Everton, I just don't see that as kind of anything, kind of much of a muchness. You know, he's a Palace legend. Everton is kind of a bit like Bolasie. I remember when he went there and it didn't really work out. So I kind of feel as if I'd like to see him go abroad. Or maybe, obviously, Arsenal links if they're still there. But I think Zaha, he's looked to me this season like so often, he looks kind of unhappy and he's looked frustrated. He's been lashing out at games, obviously. I think the stuff on social media has probably maybe affected him in some way. He's not, you know, he takes so much abuse on social media and that kind of thing, which I think he's tired of. I'd like to see him get a fresh start somewhere at a club like Dortmund, where they need a more experienced player. You know, he's 27 now. He could help them maybe challenge Bayern Munich. I think he'd fit them perfectly. So I'd like to see something like that, to be honest. Maybe a Spain like Atletico Madrid. I think he's a top player still. I still think he could go back to Manchester United, for example, and make an impact. But he definitely needs a fresh start, you know, get his head around a new challenge and re-motivate himself.
Well, we shall certainly see. Chelsea making up for lost time, though. They've already signed Timo Werner from RB Leipzig, obviously, as we know, Hatem Ziyech as well. Kai Havertz next, now that Champions League football is confirmed. He's been compared to Michael Ballack. Look, let's talk about their defensive situation in a second, but let's first look at Kai Havertz. Good Chelsea fit?
Yeah, I mean, all the indications are that he's one of the most exciting young players in Europe. And I think that this, we're just waiting now for the clubs to agree a fee. Everything else is really done. It's going to be very interesting to see how he's going to slot into this team, because they're going to be very top heavy next season. Chelsea, Pulisic, Mount, Ziyech, Werner, Loftus-Cheek, Barkley. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how Frank Lampard can get all that to click and work. But it just shows that, you know, that they're not hanging around. They want to be able to challenge Liverpool and Manchester City at the top of the league next season. But I still think, though, that the big issue for Chelsea to potentially sort out this summer, and whether they're going to have the funds to do it, is going to be at the back. 54 goals conceded this season. It's as many as Brighton, who finished 15th. It's as much as it's the most that they've conceded in a league season since 1997. It's a big problem. And I think that if they don't sort it out, then Frank Lampard is going to be under way more pressure than he was this season. This season was something of a free hit. He performed above expectations. You know, now with those signings coming in, the transfer embargo lifted, top four secured, the caveats, the excuses have kind of gone. If they're conceding at the same rate as next season, they won't get anywhere near the top, and he'll be under pressure. It's something for them to sort out. You know, they'll look at a left back if they could possibly get someone in there, a centre back, and then it comes to the goalkeeper, which is a huge issue for them. They've given themselves a big problem by spending so much on Kepa 2 years ago to make him the most expensive goalkeeper in the world. Now you've got a manager who doesn't rate him. You've got a goalkeeper with the lowest save percentage in the league, who it seems like you just need to have a shot on goal and it goes in, and he stands there and he doesn't, you know, you heard it during the Liverpool game last week where the cross comes in and the defenders are screaming at him to come out and he just stands there and Van Dijk almost scores. But how do you get him out? Because he's on huge wages. They spent so much on him. We're in a market where clubs aren't necessarily going to want to part with a lot of money for him, and Chelsea are going to want a lot of money for him. Are they going to have to come to a point where they just loan him out and pay a portion of his wages? You know, the talk about Oblak coming in from Atletico Madrid, £109 million release clause, is going to be very tricky for them.
I also heard a link with Nick Pope as well from Burnley, but half the time you just don't know whether that's somebody just putting a link together because Nick Pope's had such a good season.
I'm not sure about Nick Pope. I think that, again, probably be quite expensive. And is he, you know, with the focus on goalkeepers of being able to play out from the back as well and use their feet, different skill sets playing for Burnley, even though he is a good goalkeeper.
Yeah, I get your point. I mean, you've already kind of said an embarrassment of riches in midfield and up front. But I mean, the surprise for me, I think, is that Frank Lampard has not been, or as far as we know, has not been prioritising that defence and the goalkeeping situation. I mean, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Obviously, Ben Chilwell linked with Chelsea, of course. They had their eye on an alternative as well. I'm going to apologise if I get this name pronunciation right. Spanish left-back who can play as a winger as well, 22 years old, Marc Cucurella. Is that right? Anybody better at Spanish than me? From Getafe has been linked as well. But surely the defence, Barry, is a massive priority.
Well, you'd think it would be, and they are strengthening in areas that don't particularly need strengthening, certainly not as a priority. The one thing I would say is that it is easier to coach a defence, the defence you have, into stopping conceding goals than it is to, you know, coach your attackers to score goals. Maybe Frank Lampard thinks it's something he can work on before the season starts. There was a time not too long ago that Liverpool under Jurgen Klopp couldn't defend set pieces for Toffee. Now, obviously, they brought in Virgil van Dijk since, and that was a huge investment and one that's paid off handsomely. But I wouldn't be too concerned if they didn't bring anyone in and the season was due to started and they continued leaking goals at the current rate, then I would be very concerned. But I think it's possibly something that could be sorted out with a good defensive coach. Frank Lampard also has a big decision to make on the FA Cup final, because if he plays Willy Caballero and leaves Kepa on the bench, he's basically sending out a clear signal: I do not rate this very expensive goalkeeper we have, and will hugely reduce Chelsea's chances of getting a big fee for him.
Right, OK. Quickly, let's go through Arsenal and Spurs. Jan Vertonghen has left Tottenham after 8 years. Michel Vorm also leaving. His one-year deal expires. Pierre-Emile Højbjerg is linked with Spurs, joining from Southampton, potentially. Also had talks with Everton as well. He was left out of the Southampton squad for the game against Sheffield United on Sunday. Would he be a good Spurs fit, Jonathan?
I think he would be. I was shocked to see that he's still only 24, to be honest. He seems to have been around for such a long time. Obviously came through at Bayern Munich as a youngster, you know, under Pep Guardiola there, who helped him develop and came through. You know, he's come to the Premier League and done okay, but kind of seems to be on the out at Southampton, obviously partly because he wants to maybe move on to maybe a better financial deal and maybe a bigger, slightly bigger club in that sense. I think Spurs and Everton are the two who've been most closely linked to him. I like him. I think he's a good player. I think he's still got room to improve. You know, good midfield player, kind of quite tenacious, really determined character. I think he's got a good mentality about him in terms of he wants to win. Quite a positive mindset kind of player. And I still think he can improve under a good manager. So I think at 24, you know, it'd be a good signing for someone like a Spurs or an Everton, in my opinion. Yeah, definitely.
Let's finish off with Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, because speculation's been mounting with the likes of Barcelona being linked with him. 31, still hasn't agreed a contract extension. Have you seen, again, I don't want to bring it around to social media every single time, but have you seen the comments from his dad? He kind of posted this cryptic message on Instagram. It was in French, so I'll translate it for you. My son, who wouldn't be proud to have a son like you? Bravo, you really are a scorer. Last season, 22 goals. This season, 22 goals. I can only congratulate you. We must make the right decision for the rest of your career. They speak a lot in the press. They do not know that we are Bantu and that there is a hierarchy. The decision is taken after the advice of the wise man who is your father. We will be set very soon. Sleep peacefully, my son. Your father watches the grain. I love you. Is he going?
I'll have a pint of whatever Mr. Aubameyang Sr. is having.
I guess if he's not going to sign a new deal, then he'll have to go, because I don't think Arsenal could afford to lose him on a free next summer, given the state of their finances. But at the same time, in this market, where is he going to go? It doesn't seem like Barcelona are able to spend big money. Certainly Real Madrid aren't. He is not a young player. So, you know, where is necessarily the value for money? I wouldn't be surprised to see him just end up on a big deal at Arsenal. Whether that is going to be the best thing for Arsenal remains to be seen.
Yeah, obviously Arsenal probably need defensive reinforcements more as well. John Stones has been linked with them. Ed Ahrens and Fabrizio Romano, writing in The Guardian as well, said that Arsenal had a second bid for Thomas Partey rejected by Atletico Madrid, who won't sell him apparently for less than £45 million, with out of favour midfielder Matteo Guendouzi reportedly part of that deal. Very quickly, let's fire through exactly what's likely to happen with the relegated teams and who they have to sell. Watford, Bournemouth and Norwich, all the normal names kind of touted with staying in the Premier League but obviously going elsewhere. Craig Dawson, I saw, could end up going to Burnley in a swap deal with Ben Gibson. Who do Watford need to keep hold of if they want to go straight back, Barry?
You would imagine Watford will struggle to hang on to players like Gerard Deulofeu, Ismaila Starr, who are among their best. Troy Deeney, obviously, is a huge figure at the club. He's the captain, talisman, who's been there for 10 years. He hinted on Sunday that he might have played his last game for the club. He was humorously indignant when it was put to him that it might be his last game ever, because he said, you know, hang on, I'm only 32, I'm not that old.
I think he said it a little less politely than that.
Yes, and he also has this knee injury, and no one's sure, you know, how bad it is. But, you know, he's not getting any younger. He may look for a move elsewhere. I don't know. But I think Watford could struggle next season. It all obviously all depends who they get in to manage them. Chris Hughton seems like an obvious contender. His experience of getting clubs promoted from the Championship. But prospective managers going to Watford are going to look at what happened last season. And, you know, they got through three managers, and Hayden Mullins had two spells as caretaker, and go, is this a job I really want, or will I wait for something better to come along?
That surprises me every single time when Watford bring in a new manager. I think you do realise what they've done in the past, don't you? And you don't actually have very much, you know, time to do this. Bournemouth-wise, I suppose this is going to depend on whether Eddie Howe stays in charge. I think he's due to have talks with the hierarchy at Bournemouth in the next 48 hours over his future. And, you know, we've already mentioned Nathan Ake, but of course there's David Brooks, Josh King. You know, they've got some fantastic players who for sure will have caught the interest of other clubs, Jonathan.
Yeah, for sure. I think they're going to be raided this summer, to be honest. I think every team with anything about them should be looking at David Brooks. I think he's a wonderful player to watch. You know, really, really enjoy watching him. He's obviously had ankle operations, kept him out for 8 months, which is a bit of a concern potentially. But I think conversely, that makes it maybe less likely for him to sort of stick around and play 46 games in the Championship. So I think he'll certainly be looking to move. If I was Manchester United, I would definitely be looking at him. Leicester, maybe even Sheffield United. Maybe obviously he came through from Sheffield United, so maybe he might fancy moving back. He was a bit of a club hero there. Everton, Wolves, those kind of teams, I could see him. I think Lloyd Kelly as well at the back is a really promising young defender. Josh King, interestingly enough, sort of recently re-signed with Jim Solbakken, who's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's agent. So I think that rumour is not going to go away in terms of maybe Manchester United for Josh King, you know, former academy player. And the other one, Nathan Ake, yeah, he'll certainly leave. I think his last moment for Bournemouth was throwing himself his body on the line from a Jamie Vardy shot when they played Leicester. It would have gone 2-0 at that time. I think they were 1-0 down and they came back and won, I think, 3-1. And that just kind of epitomised Nathan Ake. I think he's really good, obviously, right-sided centre-back, but left-footed. He'll offer something different. I think bigger clubs will be looking at him for sure. Manchester City, I think, are already really in advance, already in negotiations, and I think any of the top clubs should look at Nathan Ake for sure.
Of course, that leaves us with Norwich, but they've been relegated for a couple of weeks now. So we've talked about where a lot of their star players are going to go. Likes of Todd Cantwell, obviously, going to catch the eye. Emi Buendia as well. And then suggestions that Max Ahrens and Ben Godfrey could be headed to Tottenham. Obviously, this is always a crazy time of year and pretty much everyone's being linked with everyone. So that will do with part two. Part three, we'll talk Newcastle. We have some breaking FA news for you as well. And we'll speak to Nicky Bandini and wrap up the Serie A season. Okay, ciao. Part three of Guardian Football Weekly is all about Italy. Nicky Bandini joins us. Lovely to have you on. I can hear the seagulls in the background, so I presume that you're on the beautiful coast of Brighton.
I am. I am not in Turin, where they are celebrating a ninth consecutive Serie A title for Juventus.
I mean, Maurizio Sarri, absolutely fantastic for him, 61 years old, and what an achievement that is.
I know. I think this is the thing with this story. It's sort of horribly predictable in one way, right? I get it. It's nine seasons in a row. I think a lot of people in Italy are part of this story. I get that a lot of people looking from outside look at this and think, well, this league hasn't been competitive in a long time, which is slightly misleading. I think that this season was a very, very competitive season right up until we had the coronavirus interruption, and then things went differently afterwards. Strangely differently, actually, because Juventus weren't even great afterwards. I mean, they'd lost four of their last five games coming into this. This went over Sampdoria that sealed it. So it's just the whole season has been marked very differently by it. But certainly Sarri's narrative is one that I think is still worth highlighting and talking about, because yeah, he was in his early 40s and he was still working for a bank, trading foreign exchange, and he's champion of Italy. I think it's just such an extraordinary thing that still needs to be reminded to people. I know that people have seen him play coach in England and know his story a bit, but again, when he quit that job, he did it not to even take a professional job. It was just that the amateur levels he was working at were too time consuming to continue having a full-time job in a bank. So this isn't what he was planning for. He did it for passion, and it's led him here.
Nicky, Juve can only do their own thing, but is it frustrating that Inter and Lazio made it so easy for them?
Yeah, I think this is again where it's impossible to unpick the global pandemic that we've been in from what's happened on the pitch. Because in the end, Lazio's great advantage going into the last part of the season was they didn't have to play twice a week. They were not playing in Europe. They were not in the Coppa Italia. So they had the advantage over Juventus, over Inter as well, because the Europa League, of just being able to focus on, we're going to try and win this league. And they have the thinnest squad out of that group. And so they've come back from the interruption. They've had injuries. I think personally, something to me really seems like it went awry in their heads as well. I think it wasn't just about injuries. I think they lost something in terms of the belief, the momentum, whatever you want to call it. But their results before and after the pandemic are night and day. I mean, they've lost way more games in the far smaller number of games since the pandemic than they'd had in total before. So it's impossible to look at their season as one unified thing. It's two parts. Inter, to me, Inter's different. Inter have been also, I mean, they'd already fallen, was it 8 points behind before the interruption because they lost the second Derby d'Italia against Juventus. All season long, they've been doing things that are very Inter. They've played some brilliant, brilliant football under Antonio Conte. And I think it's still worth saying that, look, the last two seasons, Inter have scraped into the top four. They have done it on the last day in the sort of most clumsy fashion possible, whereas this season they're going to be comfortably in the top four. They might well finish second. So there's progress, but there's still been so many points thrown away from ridiculous positions, and certainly in recent times, none more ridiculous than being a goal up, a man up, and with a penalty in the 61st minute against Bologna and finding a way to lose that game at home.
So obviously Inter Milan, Atalanta and Lazio all secured their Champions League spots, but just 1 point between them all. So who's going to get second?
Yeah, but you know what's funny is, I mean, it's a ridiculous scenario, so it's almost not worth mentioning, but I still sort of think it is, which is that technically the top four aren't certain of a Champions League spot, because if Napoli win the Champions League and Roma win the Europa League, one of them will come out. So there is some reason, admittedly quite tenuous, to try and make sure you finish in the top three. I don't know. I think these last two rounds come down a bit to motivation. I think Atalanta are the team playing the best football, but I think that Inter probably have the sort of slightly sort of stung pride. And I think... I think they'll hold on to second place personally, but yeah, I think it's hard because you listen to Antonio Conte. He was asked just the other day about second place and does it matter, and he said, "Look, no one remembers the name of who finished second. I've never celebrated finishing second." So the question of who gets those last points at the end of the season does come down a bit to who's more up for it, really.
So looking ahead to next season, who could challenge Juventus? Because, I mean, they're now the only team to win 9 consecutive titles in one of Europe's top 5 leagues, which is so impressive. Who's most likely to break that?
Yeah, and I think it's worth saying as well, and again, can't pick this apart from the pandemic and what's happened, because their squad is just the deepest. But this was the season when they looked most vulnerable. Sarri has had missteps. They've dropped 18 points from winning positions this season, which is extraordinary for a Juventus side. Nothing, they've not come close to that in recent seasons. They've conceded 38 goals already. You look at Conte's first Serie A winning team in that run, they conceded 20 in total. They haven't been brilliant, Juventus. And so you could look at that and think, well, they've signed more players for next season. They've got Kulusevski coming in. They've got Arthur coming in from Barcelona. Maybe this team will look more like Sarri's team and they'll be harder to beat. Or you could look at it and say, well, maybe they are losing something. Maybe they are slipping a bit. Maybe Cristiano Ronaldo is going to be a year older. I think certainly Inter are the team best positioned to challenge them, and they've already made some, I think, really great signings for next summer, and especially Achraf Hakimi is a brilliant and well-priced signing, I think, who's going to make a real difference at fullback. And I think if you look at Conte's most successful teams, the width and the tempo that his teams have set on the flanks with their fullbacks, with their wingbacks, have been fundamental. So I think that's a brilliant signing. I think the question for Inter for me is less about whether they have the tools. They're the team with the tools to do it, in my opinion, clearly. It's whether or not the Conte temperament can be held just enough in check for it to go for a second season. A lot of people feel like he does his best work in first seasons with clubs. He's already this season had plenty of sort of outbursts about, we haven't got enough experience in the team, I haven't been given everything I need, and there's this sort of situation brewing with Alexis Sanchez where he wants Sanchez back. The club isn't going to pay Sanchez £390,000 a week, which is what he's making at Manchester United. Inter have played less than half of that on the loan deal he's been on. So this tension that exists there is simultaneously driving them forwards and the challenge for them. How do you keep Conte happy and also not, perhaps not pleased to all his wins, because some of the players he wants, I think, are not what they need. So, yeah. Inter are the team best positioned. Atalanta, of course, it'd be amazing to believe it, but it's two seasons punching so far above their weight. It's a big stretch. Lazio, again, you're talking about a team that's got a wage budget, something like a third to a quarter of Juventus. You don't expect them to be there. Milan are the really interesting second sort of idea, and it's a big, big leap from them, from where they are now, to challenge Juventus. But they've been, I'm pretty sure since the restart, they've got the most points in Serie A. Stefano Pioli, who was supposed to be sort of almost a caretaker to get them through this messy season, has done so well that he's got the job full-time. You've got players there who I think really are developing into really, really special players, like Frank Kessier and Ismail Benacer is having a great end of the season. Ante Rebic has scored something like 12 goals from open play since the restart again. So Milan, a very, very dark horse, but I think that the rise of Milan is really significant and speaks to the potential for Juventus to be challenged again going forward. Because in the end, the teams that are structurally set up to compete with Juventus are Inter and Milan. They're the rich clubs. They're the clubs with the international fan base.
And Nicky, looking further down the table, so we've lost Brescia and Spal, and looks like Lecce are going to go with them, although Genoa aren't safe yet. And I was looking at Serie B to see who was coming up and would I have ever heard of them before. So it's Benevento, Crotone and Spezia occupy the top three at the moment. And the third of those teams could conceivably go up with less than 60 points. How does that work? What's the story in Serie B? Is it uber competitive or what?
Yeah, it's been a very sort of competitive season, I think, because you haven't had what you sometimes get in Serie B, which is the same in lots of second tiers, but I'd say it's more pronounced in Italy than it is, for instance, in England, that if you get one or two rich clubs down there, they can quite easily outspend everyone else, and you haven't got that this season. I think the one that people are probably most interested in is Benevento, because it's Pippo Inzaghi, so you're going to have the two Inzaghi brothers back managing in Serie A, so Pippo and Simone going at it. But yeah, these aren't... I mean, Crotone have been on a sort of upward trajectory in terms of their development. They've been in Serie A recently, and so they are on that sort of cusp of forcing their way into sort of establishing themselves at the top. But it's exactly as you'd identified it. It's that sort of season where you haven't got obvious rich front runners in Serie B, which has made for a very interesting season.
Lovely stuff. Thank you, Nicky. Always lovely to see you. Take care of yourself.
Thanks. I'm going to hang out with the seagulls.
I was going to say, don't feed the seagulls, whatever you do. Right, Fitbar Corner. Hearts and Partick Thistle have had their relegations from the Scottish Premiership and Championship confirmed. Barry, what have you got?
That's about the size of it, really. they're both very unhappy about this turn of events. I think they're quite justified in their anger. They wanted compensation or to be reinstated. They're not going to get either. Yeah, they've both vowed to come out swinging next season, but they are very unhappy with this decision. And it's a good job that this arbitrary panel reached a decision, because the Scottish Premier League, of course, starts this weekend. Something which I'd kind of forgotten, to be honest. But yeah, there has been no Scottish football since lockdown, obviously, and the Premiership starts again this weekend.
Right, a bit of breaking news that we've got here. It comes from the FA after a letter from FA chairman Greg Clark revealed that the Premier League blocked an attempt last week to increase diversity on the FA's board. According to Martin Ziegler from The Times, the FA had suggested making Paul Elliott, who's head of its Inclusion Advisory Board, a full board member of an increased number of directors to allow more BAME representatives. Jacob, I know that you've been taking a look into this. What more do we know?
Well, the FA are looking into constructing a diversity code, which would help to really... I'm not sure how much I am now a fan of the term BAME, and I think a few people who might fall into that category are now starting to have a bit of an issue with it. But in any case, looking to get more BAME representation into football, because obviously after what happened with George Floyd in America, there's obviously been since then the football's kind of turned its focus onto itself, and we've seen certain protests in starting in the Bundesliga. We see players taking a knee, and that's all well and good. But then we look around and we look for black managers working in Premier League clubs, in Football League clubs, and we don't really see it. The numbers are very, very low, which realistically makes no sense when you consider how many black players are playing in the Premier League. And we've seen people like Raheem Sterling and Jermaine Defoe talk about whether or not they would feel, given the lack of role models that they could see within the coaching community, whether they would feel able to go into become a manager. You know, we could look at people like the point made about Sol Campbell ending up at League Two clubs, having had a fantastic career, comparing that to people like Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard walking into very, very big jobs when they've had equivalent kind of careers. And Sol Campbell's obviously done very well at both of those clubs that he's been at. So, you know, we look around and we, you know, why do these things happen? Well, perhaps it's because there's a lack of diversity in the places where decisions are made. So the FA have looked at introducing this diversity code, which would help them try to improve the situation. Paul Elliott, who's the head of the FA's Inclusion Advisory Board, has been helping to put this code together. And it's been put to the FA that perhaps one of the things that would be a good thing to do would be to have Paul Elliott on their board, because rather than be a good idea to have somebody from that community in a position of actual power rather than on inclusion and advisory board, they look to put in Paul Elliott onto their board, but they've put it to representatives from the professional games. That would include representatives from the Premier League, the EFL, and that attempt has actually been blocked, which Greg Clark, the FA chairman, has revealed today, which is hugely disappointing and just sort of shows some of the obstacles that football is going to face when it comes to introducing more diversity.
So why would they block that, though? I mean, I don't understand the reasoning behind wanting to block it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not entirely clear from Greg Clark's letter, and it's a breaking story, so more information, I'm sure, is going to come out as the day progresses. There was a review in 2017 within the letter that Greg Clark has published on the FA's website today. It said that those representatives felt that that review was enough. What's happened in 2020, what's happened in the last few years within some of the problems that English football have faced would probably suggest that the review in 2017 could probably do with a little more bolstering.
It will be interesting to see if it's a Paul Elliott problem or something more sinister. It does seem a very curious scenario. I suppose we just have to wait and find out what comes out in the wash.
Yeah, Jonathan, what are your initial thoughts on it?
Yeah, I seem it's like it's breaking news, so it's hard to maybe give initial reactions. I think, as Jacob's mentioned there, there's definitely structural issues to be addressed at board level, at managerial level. I certainly agree with the perspective that there are managers maybe who do get positions maybe when it's off the back of maybe a good career and that kind of thing, and some don't. And that needs addressing, and obviously there's been things put in place and suggested to make sure that's looked at. This is obviously quite worrying if it's a case of someone being blocked from the board and and you know, any barriers being put in place to progress is obviously something that's going to be a concern. So yeah, it, obviously, like you say, it's initial news. So yeah, but it doesn't sound great, does it?
Well, I'm sure we'll find out more as the week goes on and get a little bit more context around it. Before we go, I want to talk about Newcastle, because their proposed takeover by a Saudi Arabian-backed consortium has been delayed again, this time because of a lack of clarity over who would actually be in charge at the club. Pretty crucial point, I would say. Documents were given in 16 weeks ago for the £300 million takeover, but it's still being scrutinised under the owners and directors test. Barry, I know that you've been over this story in particular. Any surprises there that delayed again?
Not really. I suppose the trite answer would be to say there's been confusion over who's supposed to be in charge at Newcastle for about 10 years now. But whatever your thoughts on the prospective owners, the fans deserve better. Steve Bruce deserves better. He needs to start planning for the season ahead, and it's very difficult for him to do that, nigh on impossible for him to do that with so much uncertainty surrounding the future of the club. It's been, I think, 16 weeks now they've been dithering over this. I can't conceivably see what is taking them so long. I assumed eventually it would be waved through. The Premier League don't seem too fussed about who owns clubs, but the fans and Steve Bruce and obviously the players at the club deserve clarity, and they deserve it quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what the Premier League lawyers are trying to establish is exactly the precise links between the consortium and the Saudi government. But, you know, with 7 weeks until the season starts, and as you say, 16 weeks ago, documents were handed over, they're going to have to think about that quick sharp before this, you know, rumbles over again and again. Listen, that's going to do for today's pod. It's been an absolute pleasure as ever. Thank you, Jonathan, very much. Lovely to meet you for the first time over Zoom.
Thank you, Faye. Been nice to join you on the show.
Jacob, go and look after your son. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you.
Barry, always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Faye.
All right, take care. Ellis James is hosting on Thursday, and Max will be back with you on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.